Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Lingitha One Talk. I orana Ali'i and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, he's American, fled to Fiji, wanted over an alleged Ponzi scheme, now caught and on his way back to the US.
If you're from the United States and you've committed crimes and you think you're going to go to Fiji to escape, you are wrong.
Also, women in business from Solomon Islands say they need help with finance in order to grow.
If you want to involve women to participate in the economic activities, we need the government to make things easier for women.
And the countdown to the region's biggest sporting event is underway with Tahiti to host next year's Pacific Games. That and so much more here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Agi Tupong, Malo Abito. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. But firstly, airlines flying out of Fiji have been told to bring their own fuel in for the rest of the month after a batch of aviation fuel stored at Nandi International Airport failed to meet the standard required for use. Passengers on Virgin Australia flights leaving Nandi are facing unscheduled refuelling stops on their way home. Our Fiji correspondent, Lide Movono, joins us now from Suva. With that, I say, Yandere, Lide.
Agnes and Yandere to you.
Yes, thank you for joining us. What a situation. What exactly are airlines being told to do at Nandi?
Agnes, it's quite an unusual situation, and to use the words of a pilot operating in the Pacific airspace, it's quite rare. What airlines are being told, particularly the ones that have to fly out of Nandi, with the exception of our national airline, Fiji Airways, they've been told to bring their own fuel with them. So a lot of them are tankering in other ports before they even get here. And that's in an official notice that had been sent out to all airmen that's been in force since Tuesday, is what we understand. Charter flights have to refuel somewhere else entirely. The only exception is for medical evacuations. So in practice, aircrafts are landing at Nandi Airport very heavily fuel laden, with enough fuel to get themselves back out again. And if they can't, they're stopping somewhere on the way home to fill up. And it's our understanding that they're filling up in ports like Port Vila as well as Honiara, if I understand that correctly, Agnes.
Mm-hmm. Lide, when we hear about aviation that is stored there at the airport failing to meet that standard required for use, what do we know about what's actually wrong with the fuel then?
What I understand is that aviation fuel comes off of the main depots, which is in our case, Vunda Marina, not too far away from the Nandi International Airport. And they come in batches every single day. And each day there are processes to check on the quality as well as the safety of this aviation fuel. Every single fuel tanker that has to bring fuel to Nandi International Airport has to go through stringent checks every day. And I'm told that over the weekend, last weekend, these checks were beginning to alert local fuel providers. And what the ABC understands is that there's a batch of fuel sitting in the ground tanks at the airport that carries too much electrical charge to meet the standard that airlines require. And the plan, as we understand it, is to dilute that. But what isn't really clear is where the problem started, whether it arrived that way in the delivery at the main depot in Vunda, or whether something happened along that value chain that meant that it became contaminated when it was at storage at the airport. And I'd stress that none of that has been officially confirmed by neither Airports Fiji Limited nor the local fuel providers and fuel installation company, Juhi.
If we look at one of the airlines that have been affected, which is Virgin Australia, have they said anything about the impact that it's having on the passengers?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we came by this information about this incident from, as we understand it, passengers that were on some of Virgin Airlines services flying out of Nandi. But Virgin Australia has confirmed in a statement that there is a fuel issue at Nandi International Airport. And the airline says that more fuel has arrived into the airport, but that they're going through the standard testing and approval processes before they can be used. But in the meantime, all flights out of Nandi are refueling partway through the journey. So on the passenger end, they can expect several delays. They can expect also unscheduled stops that they didn't book. So more transits than they would have, you know, signed up for. One Brisbane to Nandi return service was also affected and had to stop in one of our neighbor countries. And Virgin says it expects supply to resume soon, subject to those approvals, Agnes.
Okay. But also, I'm just wondering, has the Airport Fiji themselves maybe, you know, who look after the running of Nandi International Airport, have they seen anything about the contamination at all?
They haven't, sadly. We sent them questions in the early afternoon yesterday and again through the night. And in fact, just before I came on air now, I received notification from their communications team that they are about to respond to my question. And I did send them quite a few, particularly around how it is that something like this could have happened. But also, I was curious to know if it's the entire batch meant for the Nandi Airport for August that's been contaminated, which speaks, Agnes, to difficulties in fuel supplies here in Fiji, because if they now have to look at, to use or the batch that is meant for the next couple of months, it could have implications for supply issues here. So we are waiting on Airports Fiji Limited to come back to us this morning, and we haven't heard from the fuel supplier either. But what we do have is airlines in Australia, as well as flight operators, pilots in the Pacific, in several Pacific countries, confirming that they had received official notice from Nandi International Airport that they must tanker their fuel supply for their return journeys on the way here. But nothing from the people who actually run the fuel supply chain, Agnes, sadly.
Yeah, very unfortunate incident, of course, that is happening at the moment. But, Lee, there, just to confirm, I know you'd spoken a little bit on it, just how long is this expected to last? Do we have any sort of time frame given at all?
Agnes, the notice that was sent out to airmen, which went out earlier this week, indicates an expiry on that warning for the end of August, which is still about a week and a bit away. We understand from sources within Nandi International Airport that today there should be further tests on the new batch that have been brought in. So we hope that it will come to a resolution soon. But Agnes, this does pose quite a lot of inconveniences and some difficulties, given that we are the hub of the Pacific and several Pacific Island countries can only get their flights through us. And what we're told in a nutshell is that this has the potential to dissipate within the day or within the week, but it also has the potential to blow up and be something bigger than it currently is. Pun unintended.
Well, look, I know the last time I came through to Vava'u was via Nandi, so it definitely is probably an inconvenience to a lot of passengers around the region. But as always, Lida, just want to say Vinaka, thank you for bringing us the story and keeping us across the situation.
Malo, Egi.
And that is ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lida Movono.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nijin Footy Friday. Join Sam and Tini Rao every Friday as they dive into the weekend's footy action and have plenty of laughs along the way. With insights from NRLW powerhouse Sala Tonga Tuki and Fiji Rugby Union icon Namani Kurundrani, you'll get the inside scoop on Pacifica talent making waves in both rugby league and union. Nijin Footy Fridays at 1 p.m. PNG time and again at 4 on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vinaka Vaka Levon, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We stay in Fiji because what an American man has done was being wanted over an alleged $165 million crypto Ponzi scheme living in Fiji for a year. Edward Zimbari from Flowery Branch, Georgia, was deported from Fiji back to the US, where he is now facing a string of wire fraud and money laundering charges. The US attorney in Atlanta said the 59-year-old had fled to Fiji last year after learning the FBI was investigating him. FBI Special Agent Aaron Seres was one of the agents who travelled to Fiji undercover to escort him back, and says they discovered he was living a dream lifestyle on the island.
Edward Zimbardi is accused of operating a $165 million investment fraud scheme called the Crypto Program. You know, in this scheme here in the United States and around the world, he offered investment opportunities allegedly to invest in advertising. Our investigation is alleging that the investments were not made as represented, and he used the funds for other things. So we had an opportunity to engage with him in the United States in 2025. After that, he returned to Fiji. No indication to us why specifically he chose that location, but it's known as a very nice location. You have a beautiful, you know, island home there. And he was supposed to return to the United States in 2025, but never did. So that's kind of the setup of how he got there and a little bit about the case.
So when did the U.S. first alert Fiji that Zimbardi was in country? Had you been talking since last year, or was it just more recently?
At least this year, at some point early in the year. But those were just more informal discussions of trying to understand, is he there? Is he traveling in and out of the country? You know, because when we have a fugitive that's overseas, you know, we can specifically see that he flew from, you know, say the United States to Fiji. But once in country there in Fiji, you know, we lose, you know, sometimes some visibility. You know, so we're looking for partners to help us. You know, did he travel to New Zealand or Australia or somewhere in Eastern Asia? So they were helping us with that to identify that he is in country here in Fiji. So that was part of the initial law enforcement cooperation. And then once we had formal charges and we were looking to bring him into custody, and then we started having, you know, discussions about getting him back out of the country, back to the United States. And those were just recently here in 2026.
You were one of the FBI agents that traveled to Fiji undercover to escort him back to the States. What did you discover about the kind of lifestyle he'd been living for that year he'd been in Fiji?
Yeah, so from our partners in Fiji who conveyed, you know, some of the situation on the ground to us, my understanding was he was living in a luxury island home, kind of in a private enclave of the area there on the west coast side of the country and around the Nadi area. In addition, he appeared to be operating and running a coffee shop in and around the airport area there in Nadi. So, you know, he was living a good life there back in Fiji. He had all the freedoms, you know, that anyone else would. He's enjoying the island opportunities, the beaches, the, you know, living someone's maybe dream life over there in Fiji. You know, while we had investors here in the United States and around the world who were, you know, out many instances are life savings. You know, Mr. Zimbardi was running a business and potentially maybe even invest or start up other investment opportunities while he was there in country.
Yeah, the local newspaper in Fiji was reporting that there may have been possible plans to start his own investment company in Fiji. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're told the same, but I don't have any further information about that I can share at this time. I can just tell you that Mr. Zimbardi has a long history of engaging in various investment platforms and opportunities, even going back prior to our investigation. So, you know, it would be of concern for me to have him in my area, given his past circumstances. It's timely. I think it's great that he's now in custody. He's going to face charges. And again, we can't, you know, thank enough the Fijian Minister of Immigration and the authorities over there who, you know, kind of helped make this all happen to bring him back here to the United States. I think they had the same concerns that we did when we shared information about the charges that are alleged against him here in the United States. You know, they are concerned to have someone like that in their community as well. Now, charges are an allegation, you know, still have his day in court, but they were of large concern to our partners there in Fiji. And that's why they took the swift action that they did to try to get him removed from their country.
What do you think was so appealing about Fiji that he chose to relocate there of all places?
I would say, just generally speaking, Fiji is a long way off from the United States. You know, it's kind of thought of as an exotic, you know, tropical vacation location. It's very challenging to get there, you know, for U.S. law enforcement. So maybe he thought that this was a place that he was going to be able to blend in, become part of the island culture, become part of the community, and, you know, evade the long hand of U.S. law enforcement. I think he found out he was wrong on that respect. And I think also what your country's authorities in Fiji have shown is that if you're from the United States and you've committed crimes and you think you're going to go to Fiji to escape, you are wrong.
And that is FBI Special Agent Aaron Sirius speaking with our reporter, Natasha Emick. Now, economic independence was the buzzword in Honiara this week as Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands leaders came together at a historic investment forum. But as Krishnarita Amanuliang reports, women in business say they are being locked out of finance in order to grow.
As the treasurer for Solomon Women in Business, Dalsi Tekulu can see how determined women in the country are to succeed.
These women, they started very small and going through our trainings, now they grew their business.
Solomon Women in Business, also known as SIWIBA, has members that include women in agriculture, retail services, tailoring and exports. But they often come up against stumbling blocks. A key one is accessing finance for their businesses.
So one of the things that really is a challenge there is that women do not have the collateral.
She explains that this is because women rarely own their family assets.
So we realize that culturally, women in the Solomons, they do not realize how important it is, you know, to have the family assets registered under their name. Mostly it belongs to the husband, which does not qualify them to get access to these services.
She's hoping that can change with the connections she's making at the first ever PNG Solomon Islands Investment Conference in Honiara this week. A classic example she draws is Papua New Guinea's Mama Bank, a licensed microfinance bank supporting women and youths in rural communities.
We are thinking of, now that our PNG's business people are here, we would want to collaborate with them and see how they establish. And this is what we think we can establish to help our members without going through all the challenges of the other financial institutions.
Speaking at the conference, PNG's Prime Minister James Marape says the forum is a step towards moving away from relying on aid to sustain its economy.
I always say, what good is political independence without economic independence? At the very earliest, we want to be a country that also reciprocates in giving aid and grant to those who need help.
According to the Lowy Institute, aid makes up 4% of the country's GDP. For Solomon Islands, it's much bigger, with aid making up around 20% of the country's GDP. Pacific economist Dr. Kishti Sen says he believes PNG will be economically independent in the next decade, and it gives him hope for Solomon Islands.
And I think Solomon Islands' economy, amongst all the Pacific Island economies, has the best prospects because it has four industries that can contribute strongly to GDP growth, whereas the rest of the Pacific Islands kind of pretty much dependent on tourism. But Solomon Islands has got mining, they've got tourism, they've got manufacturing, and they've got agriculture.
He says agriculture, like cocoa beans, could be key. The country produces 7,000 tons of beans a year, which brings in 550 million Solomon dollars a year.
Now imagine if you upscale from 7,000 to 21,000 tons. What we need is to train farmers with modern planting techniques, give them the planting equipment and develop their expertise.
The Solomon Islands economy is set to grow by 3.4% this year. And at the forum, Prime Minister Matthew Wale says he hopes partnering with PNG will see that expand.
Let us create investments that lead to jobs, partnerships that generate growth, and projects that improve livelihoods. and let us demonstrate that Melanesian cooperation delivers real economic returns.
But Solomon Women in Business Treasurer Dulcie Tekulu says for the country to succeed, women need to be prioritized.
I would just like to say if you want to involve women to participate in the economic activities, we need the government to make things easier for women so that they can come in and, you know, be part of what the government offers.
And Solomon Women and Business Treasurer Dulcie Tekulu ending that report from Chris Narita Almanu Leong.
Pacific Beat.
Right, if you just joined us, Maloa Pito, this is Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Egi Tupou. Here's the stories, though, that we've had on the show so far. Airlines flying out of Fiji have been told to bring their own fuel in for the rest of the month after a batch of aviation fuel stored at Nandi International Airport has failed to meet the standard required for use. Also, an American living the lifestyle in Fiji has been wanted of an alleged Ponzi scheme. And women in business from the Solomon Islands say they've been locked out of finance in order to grow. Still to come, though, the countdown to the region's biggest sporting event is underway, with Tahiti to host next year's Pacific Games. But right now, it's time to head to your news wrap. Yes, Malo Tamae Bombongini, welcome to Pacific Beat, where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. Brought to you by our producer, Dana Kerimov, who's in the studio with me this morning.
Good morning.
My gosh, it's Friday.
Nice to have you here on a Friday.
Yeah. Why not be here on a Friday? But yes, I appreciate you coming through. There is a couple of stories that we're going to get through. Also, firstly, I believe there is an update to our actual first story that we ran around Fiji Airport, saying Nandi International Airport remains open and operational, but with safety protocols maintained.
Yes, so our reporter in Fiji, Lide Mavono, actually got a response from Fiji Airport just as we were talking just now.
Right.
And so what's going on is basically Fiji Airport says that it's monitoring the fuel situation closely and is working with the airline suppliers and ground handlers on contingency planning to minimize disruption. But that points out questions that the fuel itself, but it points out questions about the fuel itself elsewhere, saying supply and quality are managed by the fuel service providers, and they're working with the relevant authorities. Its own job, it says, is keeping the airport itself running safely. So it acknowledges the inconvenience to passengers and says it will support efforts to restore normal supply as soon as predictable.
Beautiful. I'm glad we got that update. So thank you very much to our reporter, Lede Mavono, sending that through. True. All right, we're heading to a bit of sport here. Fiji and a rugby player for Melbourne Storm, Tuika Mitamita, has announced his immediate retirement following medical advice from specialists. Goodness, what happened here?
Yeah, so Kamika Mita suffered from a stroke back in March, leaving him needing heart and brain surgery.
Wow.
Now, the 32-year-old had hoped to return to the Storm this year and potentially captaining Fiji at the World Cup again later this year. But unfortunately, that was not going to be possible.
Wow. Coming to me this career, though, isn't the only medical experts who have had their eye on, right?
Yeah. So Melbourne Storm is still gathering medical opinions on the Tongan international player Elisa Koata's future. Now, that's likely to be assessed further in the next month, but both Katoa and the Storm still hope that he'll be able to play, so they're both very keen. But after three head knocks in the space of about 90 minutes in Tonga, with Tonga last year, that led to seizure activity and bleeding on the brain. So it'll be up to medical advice on whether or not he's able to return to the field.
And I don't know if you got to actually see that game because we all watched it too. And we all watched those three head knocks and it was quite a thing to watch. And I know a lot of love and prayers went out to Eliasa because,
yeah.
I mean, a brain bleed is serious. And then just to now hear about Kamika Mitha. Goodness, bit of a hard hit, no pun intended, obviously. But just, really, really sad to hear. But hopefully all the best for both of them. All right, let's head to Papua New Guinea's path to the FIFA Women's World Cup. Seems like it's a little clearer now after the draw for the preliminary phase of the playoff tournament.
Yeah, so the Billums will face Uzbekistan, Chinese Taipei and Ghana as they look to advance to the final phase next year. So two teams from that preliminary phase will advance to be joined by four other nations. And then from that group, it will be determined from that group, the final three teams that will qualify for the 2027 tournament in Brazil. Now, that preliminary phase will take place at a centralized venue in November and December of this year, with the host and match schedule being confirmed by FIFA in due course.
Nice, nice. Thank you for that. We end off with some really feel-good story. The United Auckland Gospel Choir have won gold at the 2026 World Choir Games in Sweden.
Yeah, so a competition-heavy news wrap today. But the event, which was once known as the Choir Olympics, according to RNZ Pacific, had a 50-strong group who were predominantly Maori and Pacifica and was the only New Zealand Pacific team to compete in the competition, which is traditionally dominated by teams from the United States and the United Kingdom. Obviously, the United States being the origin of gospel as we know it now.
Yes.
Now, the competition hosts two levels. There's an open competition and a champions competition. And back in 2024, the United Auckland Gospel Choir won gold in the open competition, meaning they were able to enter and then ultimately win the champions competition this time around in Sweden.
Yes, and I have to give a shout out to Simon, who leads that choir.
Oh, great.
I saw their progression, you know, from practicing to going off. So, man, well done to winning gold. What a feat. Yeah. All right, love that. Thank you so much, Dana, for coming through and bringing us our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Manuia Letea, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Let's look into the world of sport now. Well, it's been 17 years since a team from Solomon Islands last made the OFC Champions League final, and no team from the country has ever won the big prize. So Central Coast will be out to make history in Fiji tomorrow when they take on perennial title holders Auckland City. Now, the two sides have already met during the group stage of the tournament, with the team from Honiara leading for most of that game, until Auckland struck twice in 2 minutes near the end to take the win 2-1. So a closely fought final would appear to be on the cards, but in Rafaleae, Central Coast's hat-trick hero from the semi-final win over Galaxy FC in their ranks, the Solomons outfit might just have the extra ingredient they need to get the job done. Well, we're joined now from Honiara by soccer commentator and former Solomon Islands international, Alex Waimora. With that, I say welcome to Pacific Beat, Alex.
Good morning and welcome. Yes, thank you for having me on the program as well.
Of course. Well, I suspect, Alex, there's plenty of excitement in the Solomons right now. I mean, it's very much a soccer-loving nation with a team on the brink of history, yes?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the news has definitely spread around all the radio station, the local TV as well. Especially we're watching online, so there's so much excitement. And for me as well, I watched the game that Solomon Islands went through Waitakere. That's 17 years ago, and now I'm also watching this one too. So yes, it's the excitement is everywhere.
It's good to hear. Now I know, Alex, you have posted a very passionate article on social media talking about Rafaleae and the captain, Jarvin Wai, players, you know, that you have watched grow and develop over a number of years. How gratified are you to see their soccer journeys reach this point?
Well, it's an emotional one here, and like everyone say, football connects with your emotions, especially in Solomon Islands, where it's a part of our lives. You can tell football and Rafaleae and Jarvin Wai. I've worked with these guys in the last 10 years or so, and yeah, I posted a picture which is 6 years ago, and it was of them. They came and helped me out. I was doing a little football academy in the local community that I have. It was just to get kids off from the negative influences around drugs, drinking, and they gave their time without any form of payment, or they were with me for a total of 3 months, just coming in training. They live in their respective communities, but they came and helped me. And when I look back at the whole tournament now, the game, it was obvious that the leadership was from Jamin, the mentality to win was from Rafa, and it was emotional. I say these guys, that's the type of players that can take Solomon Islands further.
Well, At his best, though, Alex, could Rafalea be the difference that wins the game for Central Coast? What do you think?
Oh, definitely. Rafa has a unique mentality that we've seen grown over the years. A lot of us Solomon Islands were known to be shy and we treat football more like, oh, it's a fun game. But when it comes to Rafa, he's just had that age where he can keep on going. Even when he's not playing at his best, he will keep on going. And that's what actually get him the hat-trick against Galaxy. And speaking of hat-trick against Galaxy, my comrade Batram Suri too is coaching Galaxy. So I guess he might have lost the game, but he might also be proud of Rafa's performance as well.
Well, what would a Central Coast win mean, you know, more broadly for the future of soccer in Solomon Islands?
Well, the excitement just came from Solomon Kings recently. There's packed stadiums. Everyone's wearing this souvenir around. This particular win for Central Coast, it would hit home even better. Central Coast existed as a club that came from church. A lot of, if you can say, there's football and there's religion here in Solomon Islands. So if it wins, it's going to be massive because a lot of people can integrate themselves with Central Coast as it is from the local league. We all watch the local league. So when it comes, if that's a win, and I believe the Central Coast can win, there will be party here. We'll be celebrating throughout the week. I think maybe a lot of my mates won't go to work. And yeah, it will be crazy.
Well, Alex, I understand. What about Auckland City? I believe you have a personal connection with someone there.
Oh, definitely. Well, first of all, I was playing and also in school with Mike Denhai, is the main midfielder. And recently I've worked with Southend United. They had Christian Gray, the player from Auckland that scored in the FIFA Club World Cup as well. So I know them very well. And I've worked with Auckland in past competitions as well. So I do have a strong connection with Auckland. But unfortunately on this one, I'm definitely going for Central.
Yeah, well, and this is it. Clearly, you're hoping for a Central Coast win. But right now, after a bit of an arduous semi-final, how do you rate their chances, Alex?
Well, compared to their performance against Auckland, I think they did much better than their recent one against Galaxy in terms of position and that confidence. But again, football isn't played on paper, it's played on the field. So if Central Coast can gather themselves up, have a better performance than their semi-final, definitely it's a game, football, like we say, the game that played on the field. And we have all the ingredients, especially Javin and Rafai Leai there, and the coach himself, I have to make mention. I worked with and under him as well, Jacob Molly. He's a technician. He knows his players, and he's that local connection to the player that is something that is missing. So I believe if they played with confidence and tried to get into their positive mindset, get the ball more controlled, they're definitely going to win. But Auckland, again, they got so much experience up their sleeves.
Well, there's nothing like an underdog story, right, Alex? So let's hope to see that win. And I'm sure we'll be listening out for the celebrations on the streets all the way from Honiara there in Solomon Islands. But I want to say thank you so much, Alex, for coming on the show this morning.
I'm grateful. And hopefully Central Coast can do some magic and we've been celebrating all through the week.
All right. Thank you for that. That is Alex Waimora with his thoughts on the OFC Champions League final, which kicks off at 3 p.m. local time in Bar tomorrow afternoon.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the countdown to the region's biggest sporting event is underway with Tahiti to host next year's Pacific Games. With less than a year to go to the opening ceremony, preparations are taking place across the Pacific in different sports, including triathlon. Next week, the World Triathlon Development Regional Cup, which is one of the sport's biggest events, will take place in Tahiti. Stephen Damien is one of the regional development coordinators for the sport and says next week's event will be a dress rehearsal for next year's Pacific Games.
The area that we are competing in, it's on the island of Moaea. It's also a tourist island, so we try as much as possible to not have a lot of impact on the business around there as well. The purpose of the event also, it's also the World Triathlon Development Regional Cup. So we have about 8 or 10 countries from Oceania competing in this. This is one of the biggest gathering of athletes from Oceania coming to compete in this test event, which is for us a big achievement. We have 26 male and 19 women. They'll all be competing in this race. And then after the test event, the athletes and the coaches will then remain for another week for their development camp. For the test event itself, we are having a race. It's called a sprint triathlon. So it comprises of a 750-meter swim, a 20K bike, and then a 5K run. That's just for the test event. However, for next year, for the Pacific Games, traditionally we have three races in the Pacific and the mini games. We have a sprint triathlon. We also have an aquathlon, which is a swim, run, swim. And then we also have what you call a 4x4 relay.
Is the sport of triathlon becoming popular, or is it already very popular in Oceania?
So New Zealand and Australia are two of the top Oceania countries. They're the top-tier countries competing on the world stage. So it's popular in New Zealand and Australia. In the other Oceania federations, it goes through, it's a popular in some countries sometimes, and in other times the interest fades. And this is because sometimes one federation will have a really strong administrative body that promotes the sport as well as all enough events to a junior development program to let a lot of athletes train. However, having said that, we're lucky in the sport in that triathlon is one of the mandatory sports in the, both the mini games and the Pacific Games. So that means when a host country hosts the Pacific Games or mini games, triathlon on the list of games like athletics, swimming. Yeah, so we're lucky in that sense. So our the island federations have an opportunity to compete all the time. Also, we are lucky in that international federation through our regional federation, Oceania, we have funding to host two regional races every year. So this gives us an opportunity for our athletes in the region to aim for. So like, for example, this year we had a race in Palau beginning of the year, and then we have this one here in Tahiti. Next year, there'll be two more places for us to race. This is aside from the Pacific and the mini games.
The sport of triathlon, is it popular in all Pacific Island nations, or sometimes smaller nations find it a bit challenging?
Yes. I think in most Pacific Island countries, it's very challenging because, first of all, most of the countries don't have bike shops to sell proper cycling bikes, and then also cycling equipment like bike shoes with clip-ons or bike helmets as well. So that makes it difficult for the sport of triathlon, you know, for people to promote the sport. I'll just give some country-by-country scenario. In CNMI or Marianas, very strong triathlon community. They got access to, you know, because they're part of, you know, after the U.S., they got access to good equipment. They got really good roads for cycling and good places to swim. However, the last two big typhoons that hit the country really put the country back. Like a few of their volunteers and athletes had to move either out of to the mainland, or they have to focus on rebuilding because their houses got destroyed and stuff. Focus on rebuilding their own lives and put triathlon on the sort of back burner while they try to rebuild their lives. Other countries like, say, Papua New Guinea, a couple of years ago, they had a very strong executive that promoted junior development as well as club competitions. So they had, you know, club competitions in Port Moresby and other parts of the country, and a lot of interest from junior athletes. And same with other island countries as well. Young athletes become adults, and then they have to worry about either further education or raising families. So without, you know, strong base of junior athletes coming along, the sport of triathlon sort of not as strong as it used to be. Other countries like Samoa, very strong executives. You know, they when they took over the club, you know, over the last 3 years, it's becoming one of our strongest triathlon federations in the region, with athletes, you know, both in town and in the village as well.
Tell us about the recent Olympic Games where a girl from Guam represented the sport of triathlon in the Olympic Games. What's the story?
So in Guam, we got a small country, but they got very strong competition there. They got strong event managers that run races. And, we got one of our first Oceania Olympians that comes from Guam, that's now based in Europe, preparing for the next Olympic Games. So she competed actually in Tokyo, and now she's building up to compete in the next one. And then, of course, we got other countries like Solomon Islands. It was strong a couple of years ago, and then after the Pacific Games in 23, the executives and athletes have, sort of matured, and then they've had a move because of jobs and further education. So now it's coming to a rebuilding phase again. But they still got some good coaches and athletes that are coming to Tahiti as well.
And that there is Stephen Damien, one of the regional development coordinators of the sport of triathlon in Oceania, speaking there with Caroline Terriman. And we head back to Papua New Guinea, who has the second highest mortality rates from cervical cancer in the Pacific region, ranking 12th globally. The average diagnosis age is 50 years old, but almost all cases are caused by persistent HPV infection. Human papillomavirus, or HPV, is preventable through immunisation during childhood, but it has not been PNG's national immunisation schedule until now. PNG received its first batch of single-dose HPV vaccines earlier this month, marking the start of a national rollout to vaccinate girls between the ages of 9 to 14 years. Dr. Satish Gupta, the UNICEF PNG Chief of Health, says that by next year, the vaccine should be an embedded part of the immunisation schedule countrywide.
So if we go about the cervical cancer issue in the country, this is the second commonest cancer in women after breast cancer. And it's about 1,000 plus women every year gets cervical cancer, and about 650 they die every year. Vaccine is the only way to prevent this cancer. Many countries globally, they have already introduced this vaccine. PNGs have started actually 2 years back in one of the provinces as a pilot project. Now it's planned to introduce nationwide, starting with two provinces, NCD and Central, next month, and then scaling up to the other provinces.
And do you know why it took as long as it did to introduce the HPV vaccine?
So actually every country that takes their own internal disease burden assessment. They also decide based on the resources of vaccines availability and also internal administrative approval process. So now since we have the data about the incidence of cervical cancer in the country, so this was actually presented to the technical experts, and they are the ones who advised to introduce this vaccine. And also recently, some years 2022, WHO also make a new recommendation on the vaccine introduction, switching from the two-dose vaccine schedule to a single-dose schedule. So all of these technical considerations were taken into account when the country decided to introduce HPV vaccine. So Western Highland Province started 2 years back, and based on the lessons learned, now it's planned to do a national introduction.
Yeah, and what kind of lessons were learned from that trial stage?
Yeah, so normally the vaccinations are given to the children, no? Less than 1 year of age. That's the main age group for any vaccination program. But HPV vaccine is slightly different. It's given to the girls between 9 to 14 years of age, which means a school-based vaccination rather than an infant-based vaccination, which are used for other vaccines. So how to go and how to do vaccination in schools, what are the precautions and what are the preparations needed to do this vaccination in this specific age group. And that's what Mount Hagen, actually Western Highland Province, when they introduce, they use the school-based vaccination strategy. And the same strategy now is being used to introduce into the national program. And secondly, also how to communicate this to the community awareness issue, what are the messaging, and how to explain to the community about the cervical cancer. Because sometimes it's not easy for people to understand what is this vaccine is about, why we only need to give it to the girls between 9 to 14 years of age, while the cervical cancer happens at a later age. So all this feedback we received from the community and also from the school vaccination program, and that's what actually now the country is using these lessons for introduction.
I suppose if we look at that introduction with the 100,000 that Papua New Guinea has received, and then the further 180,000 that they're going to receive. That brings the total supply, obviously, to 280,000 vials. What kind of dent in the HPV and then cervical cancer rates do you think that amount is going to make?
So this is only the starting quantity, no? For the first and the second rounds. But next year, there will be further shipment of the vaccines, which will come to cover the remaining provinces. So the plan is that this year and the next year, all 22 provinces in the country will receive this vaccination. So it will be a national introduction spread over 1 year. And then after 1 year, all the girls which are becoming 9 years of age will continue to receive this vaccine in the routine immunization. The impact of the vaccine is a long term, because the cervical cancer happens at a later age. So the actual impact in the country, we will see over a period of time. But we have the data globally, and WHO, based on that data, made the recommendation to introduce this vaccine globally.
How long would UNICEF be involved in this rollout program? And is there enough funding for this to continue on long term sustainably?
So this 6.2 million actually is only for the initial introduction, but there will be also a smaller cost which will be required in the later years for the routine immunization, because that time it will be only one cohort. So the vaccine needs will be like 1/5 of what we need now, only for the 9 years girls. So government, as I know, that they have already budgeted this vaccine for this year and next year. And when they normally do the annual submission, budget submission for the vaccine procurement, this will be included into the immunization vaccine forecasting. And UNICEF is helping government to not only procure this vaccine, but also the other routine immunization vaccines. So that support is expected to be continued. So the school health program is a very important platform to deliver this vaccine. And government also is using this opportunity to not only give HPV vaccine, but also to strengthen the school health in general, which means to also provide iron folic acid supplementation or deworming tablets to the girls in that age group, so that in the school, they don't only get the vaccine, but also the other supplements like which are required for the for this age group girls in the schools.
And that was the UNICEF PNG Chief of Health, Dr. Satish Gupta, talking to Dana Kirimov.
Nijin Footy Friday. Join Sam and Tini Rao every Friday as they dive into the weekend's footy action and have plenty of laughs along the way. With insights from NRLW powerhouse Sala Tongatuki and Fiji Rugby Union icon Namani Kurundrani, you'll get the inside scoop on Pacifica talent making waves in both rugby league and union. Nijin Footy Fridays at 1 p.m. PNG time and again at 4 on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Looking back at some of our main stories, airlines flying out of Fiji have been told to bring their own fuel in for the rest of the month after a batch of aviation fuel stored at Nundi International Airport failed to meet the standard required for use. American citizen Edward Zimbardi from Flowery Branch, Georgia, has been deported from Fiji back to the US, where he is now facing a string of wire fraud and money laundering charges.
If you're from the United States and you've committed crimes and you think you're going to go to Fiji to escape, you are wrong.
And for the first time in 17 years, Solomon Islands has made the finals of the OFC Champions League final. And tomorrow, Central Coast will face off against Auckland City to do what no Solomon Islands team has ever done before.
Or if Central Coast can gather themselves up, have a better performance than their semi-final, definitely it's a game, football, like we say, it's a game that played on the field. And we have all the ingredients, especially.
Well, we will be back next week, Monday morning at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, have a great weekend, guys. O toa o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.